Welcome to Season 2 of My Unknown Truth, a podcast sharing stories and experiences of adoption and foster care in Australia and around the world. My name is Nadia Levitt, and while exploring my own adoption journey, I wanted to create a space for others to share their stories too. In Season 2, I will be sharing fascinating personal experiences, some that unfold over long periods of time, and stories bravely told in memoirs and autobiographies. I discuss with a range of professionals in the field who may help navigate the complex foster care system, or understand childhood trauma and effects of separation, or how to support parents who wish to foster or adopt across the state, national, and international lines. By sharing a range of experiences, it may help increase connection and awareness around adoption and foster care in Australia, facilitate informed discussion, and encourage more people to open their hearts, minds, and homes to children in need. Hey listeners, today I'll be talking with Jo. Jo is an adopted person, born in Adelaide in 1969. She lives with her family in Sydney's Northern Beaches. Creativity has been a constant in her life, and she has worked in advertising, marketing and design for many years, but is now quietly forging a new path as a yoga teacher after feeling its transformative effects in her own life. Here is Jo's story. Hi, Jo, and welcome to My Unknown Truth, the Australian Adoption Podcast. It's so nice to be chatting with you today. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land. We are on the land of the Garigal people, and we respect those elders past, present, and emerging. So we might just start by saying welcome. Now, for those listening, I met Jo in April this year in Bali on a yoga retreat, and we were doing our advanced 40-hour training with Power Living Yoga, and I cannot highly recommend going with Power Living and Duncan Peake. He's amazing, his training style and his studios. And that was a fantastic retreat. We absolutely loved it. And on the first night, I remember you standing behind me waiting to line up getting our dinner. And you were the first and only person that asked me what the topic of my podcast was. And when I said adoption, and you said, I'm adopted and I've got a story, it was just amazing that it was meant to happen. So we were meant to meet today. And thank you for inviting me into your home today and willing to share your story today. Thank you. Can you tell me about your adoption story?
Sure. Well, I was born at Queen Victoria Hospital in Adelaide in December of 1969, and they ran an adoption agency there, I've since learnt, until sort of the mid-70s apparently, when, you know, I guess society started changing. Single women's pension came in. The Queen Victoria Hospital is now part of the Adelaide Hospital, but it's still standing there. My birth mum, I don't know if that's technically the right terminology anymore, but that's kind of what I call her, was originally from the Brossa Valley, from a Lutheran family. That kind of group of people were known as the Brossa Deutsch, I've since learned. And I think when she was around 11 years old, there was a big flood in Angaston in the Brossa Valley, and her whole family, her mum and dad and her brother and sister, they moved to Hermannsburg Mission, which is a very, very remote place, about 120 kilometres. I think it's southwest of Alice Springs. I haven't actually been there. It was a mission established by the Lutheran missionaries back in the late 1870s. I mean, they took 20 months to walk up there. They wanted us to their dream was to establish a Lutheran community in Central Australia. So it is the land of the Western Arunta people, and it's where Albert Namatjira, the artist, is from. So my birth mum was in Adelaide. She was studying nursing, I believe, at Adelaide Uni. And so I think it was a very stressful time for her. Her mum passed away while she was pregnant with me, and she had in her younger life suffered from a lung condition called bronchiectasis. So during her pregnancy, she had to have IV penicillin antibiotics. And she hid her pregnancy with a corset until she was about 6 or 7 months pregnant. And she said her brother was living in Adelaide at the time, and he came to see her and gave her a hug and said, "Gosh, you've put on a lot of weight." And then she kind of broke down and, you know, confessed. My biological father was apparently already engaged when he started the relationship with my birth mum. So I'm not sure how that all played out. At the end of her pregnancy, she ended up staying with an aunt of hers who had also in her younger life given up a baby for adoption. Mm. And he went on to become a well-known surgeon, apparently. And my birth mum found a scrapbook that she had kept for many, many years about this son that she'd given up. I was relinquished at birth in that a pillow was held over my birth mum's face, and she didn't get to see me or touch me. And she remembers looking down at the black and white floor, and that's pretty much it. I was there, I guess, until Christmas Eve when my adoptive mum and dad received a telegram on their doorstep, just like back in the dark ages of communication, to say that there was a baby ready for them and to please call to let the hospital know what time they'd be collecting me. All I know about the time directly after my birth is that a nurse had named me Leanne. So that's kind of weird.
Yeah. But I think that's what they, from previous stories, nurses have been naming. Naming babies.
Relinquished babies.
That's right. Yeah.
So I guess the best way for me to describe it is that I was kind of tuned out as a kid. My best friend nicknamed me Dozy and still calls me that today. So I think it was a bit of a survival mechanism for me to sort of deal with the innate stress of stuff. And my mind just disconnected a bit. I mean, I wasn't walking around like a zombie, but it's definitely hazy. And I don't have a lot of clear memories from my childhood. It's a blur. And I just never felt like I belonged with these truly lovely people in whose home I lived. I just didn't. And it was as if they were speaking a different language to me completely. I didn't feel things the same way they did. I didn't see things the same way they did. I didn't problem solve the same way they did. You know, I didn't really look like them either. And I just felt different in every way. And I think I always felt like there was a hole inside of me where I should be. Mm. And I guess with the benefit of time and maturity now, you know, I can now see that. But it's a very different experience when you're living through that, you know, as a child. Yeah.
When did you find out you were adopted?
From as early as I can remember. And actually, there's a lot of things that my adoptive mum has done and just her sort of personality type that I have found very difficult. But one thing I have a lot of respect for is the fact that she was told by a doctor to tell me as early as she thought I would understand. And she did do that. And I think it would have gone against every cell in her body because she was very much in denial about me even being adopted. You know, she sort of conveniently forgot it, basically.
Yeah. Why was that, do you think?
Maybe she just couldn't cope with the fact that she couldn't have children. I think a certain amount of envy and jealousy of her sort of closer family who were having children at that time. Yeah. Mm. She was almost to the point of being obsessive about not letting anyone know, always admitting, never telling. And I remember having a conversation with her as an adult and saying, "Oh, you know, such and such wouldn't know you were adopted, would she?" I said, "Mum, I've been friends with her for 20 years. Of course she knows I'm adopted." She said, "But why would you tell her?" And I said, "Well, it's who I am. It's my truth. It's such a big part of me. Mm. You know, she couldn't fathom it.
Wow. Yeah. And so growing up would have been different. There would have been no opportunities for that open conversation
on
the table. She would have just closed all those doors. Had you ever told someone in front of her, or you just knew that you could not have?
No way. Yeah. I remember as a pretty small kid, and this is obviously an isolated incident, but as a pretty small kid, maybe around 5-ish or 6, saying to her, I it's like a movie in my mind. I remember this very clearly. I remember not much else, but I remember this really clearly. And saying to her, "So who's my real mum again? Like who?" And I mean, she got really angry. Like really angry to the point where I thought she was going to like sort of slap me. And I just sort of retreated. And then my adoptive dad came in to see me and said, "Don't ask your mum that again." You know,
it's always steering towards her, and it's all about her and her feelings and protecting, as opposed to, being about you and what your needs would have been
when
you're a child.
Very much so. And I think that's a common theme through adoption, certainly from my era.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's definitely that era as well to keep it all private and secret. And it mainly because if people found out, then it does go to the mum thinking, they weren't able to have kids.
Yes, and there's a certain amount of shame with that as well.
Failure of being a female. Yeah.
Definitely, yeah. There was a lot of pressure to conform and to deny that. And, and it was very clear to me that's how we had to operate.
So what age did you first tell someone that you were adopted, and who was it to?
Good question. I actually don't know. I, as a younger kid, sort of under age 12, I don't think I would have mentioned it. Because I was an only child, I felt a bit ostracized anyways, particularly at primary school. So I don't think I would have mentioned it. Certainly with my friends, who I'm still friends with now from high school, I definitely spoke to them a lot about it. But, yeah. And there were quite a few girls. I went to a girls' school. There were quite a few girls at school, and then sort of our broader group of friends, neighbours and things, that were adopted at that time, because, it was when I was born was very much the heart of Australian forced adoptions. Yeah. I don't think I mentioned it as a young child. It was very clear not to talk about it.
I can relate to your story in similar ways, being an only child myself as well, and not having the communication or the connection between like what you're feeling and what is happening, and then to be able to voice your experience or whatever, put it into any kind of words. And I wasn't called Dosi, but I was people would look at me and go, like click their things and go, "You awake?" Yeah. And my memory is fragmented as well. So I'm constantly, in a sense, piecing the puzzle together and stories. And it's hard because you don't want to make it up. You want to be as truthful as you can. But if you don't remember chunks of your experience of your childhood, it can be quite hard to make more sense of it. And
absolutely.
Yeah. And I slept a lot. I don't know if you slept a lot, but I used to sleep a lot, I think, to try and get through if I was having a tough time, because I couldn't get it out verbally, so I just would sleep. I would sleep on the way to school, and I'd have like a piece of toast just in my hand, and I'd fall asleep. Just
really?
Yeah, and in class I would just tune in, tune out. And even now as an adult I'm more aware of it, but, I catch myself sometimes, having that selective concentration or selective memory, and people recall things and say, "Don't you remember that?" And I'll be like, "No, I have not a clue what they're talking about."
I have that a lot. When I go back to Adelaide to visit family and friends, and now my adoptive mum's in a nursing home, so I stay with one of my high school friends, which is actually awesome. And she'll always say things like that to me, like, you know, such and such, don't you remember, you know, and I'm like, I have no clue what you're talking about. She goes, are you joking? You were there. I remember. I'm like, I don't remember it. I don't.
Yeah.
I have no clue what you're talking about, you know. So,
yeah.
It's
yeah,
funny.
So it must be a thing. Mm. It must be a thing where you have, you as a child, like when you were born, it must be just something where, yeah, you block out certain.
You just tune out, I think. You sort of like, it's a coping mechanism just to get through.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't sleep a lot. In fact, I always found sleep very hard to come by.
Mm.
I remember. Yeah. I would really struggle to get to sleep. Yeah, I mean, something like related to that, I was remembering that when I must have been about 10 or 11 and my adoptive mum dropped me off at a school camp, and I was paralyzed with, I don't know, I guess anxiety, fear. I couldn't explain why at the time. I think now it was because just that trauma of abandonment and just thinking maybe now, you know, maybe they won't come back to pick me up. I was physically ill from it. I was actually physically, like, she had to come and pick me up the next day because I'd been vomiting for like hours. It was horrific. I still remember how it felt.
Mm.
It was awful.
Jo was forcibly removed from her mother immediately after her birth at Queen Victoria Hospital in South Australia, whose adoption agency enforced a policy based on the clean break theory, where no contact or attachment was permitted between mother and child. Jo says that for many adoptees, the effect of this inhumane practice is a profound loss of self and a lifetime of trauma. What age did you start searching for your birth family? How did you do it? How did you feel at the time searching for your birth parents?
Well, when I was about 19, the adoption laws in South Australia changed, so you could apply to get your original birth certificate. So I think it was through Family and Community Services. I had to make an appointment with a social worker, and I did that, and she was a lovely woman. I mean, I look back now and think, wow, there was no counselling, you know, if you wanted to try and contact your birth parents or mum or whatever. There was no kind of counselling offered prior to doing that. She was a nice lady, and she basically, you know, just passed an A3 yellow envelope across the table to me and said, open it. And I was like, oh, okay. So I pulled out this piece of paper that had another piece of paper stuck on top of it, like in each corner with glue. And it had a big stamp in capital letters, I remember, and it said never to be revealed. And so I sort of like looked back up at her to check, is this all right?
Did you do this by yourself?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. My adoptive mum was vehemently against me doing this. She did not want me to find, have any contact, know anything. But I did it anyways.
Yeah.
Because I felt I had to. I felt absolutely compelled to do it. And so I pulled back the piece of paper on top of the birth certificate, and for a split second I thought it was the same surname as my best friend's surname because it's a German surname, and like there's lots of German surnames in Adelaide, especially from the Barossa and all that. And it wasn't, though, but it was very similar.
Imagine that.
I know.
That
I was just like, oh, my God, I'm like related to her. Anyways, I wasn't. And then, you know, the social worker offered to facilitate communication, so I wrote a letter. And then I guess it was about a year and a half later when my birth mum responded. You know,
that's a long time.
Yeah, it was quite a long time. It was quite a long time. You know, it was very difficult because I did have a letter that was like non-identifying information about my biological parents that I think I found. I don't think my adoptive mum gave it to me. I think I found in documents and stuff at some point when I was about maybe 14. And it said on there that it sort of gave like physical descriptions. It said something like, your biological mother has very dark olive skin or something like that, and grew up on Hermannsburg Mission or you know, in remote Central Australia or something like that. And it said that your biological father was also from Alice Springs or grew up in Alice Springs or something. So from that, I thought, well, I'm probably Indigenous. Like I mean, it was so few facts. And so, you know, I guess in some ways that it was helpful that I thought that at the time because it helped me resolve why I felt so out of place. You know, I just thought, well, I haven't grown up with culture. I don't know anything about that side of me. So no wonder I feel so displaced. But that was not the case as far as I'm aware. It's just, you know, this search for self and identity, and it was all over the shop.
Yeah. And that with those two pieces of information, I mean, there's only a certain amount of conclusions that you can make. Having that idea of yourself, but then not actually knowing whether it's true or not. So going, I could be that, but I might not be. Yeah, especially at that time of your life too, at 14. It's just, yeah, everything just compounds at that age as well.
Absolutely. So I sent the letter and she responded.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when I was about, I guess, 20 or so, maybe, yeah, probably 2021, we met for the first time.
And what was that like?
Kind of underwhelming, I guess. We met in like a cafe. Mm. And she walked in. I look exactly like her. There was no question. You know, I'm really very similar physical appearance. And she was quite reserved. She brought photos of the subsequent children she'd had. And she was obviously nervous. I felt she just only focused on them. She didn't really ask about me or that much. But, you know, we started a relationship and, you know, slowly, slowly I met her husband and I met her children. Her children were obviously younger than me and they were, you know, sort of younger teenagers at the time. And she said to me, she had already told her husband that she had had me, but she obviously hadn't told her children and she didn't want to tell them until they were older. Mm-hmm. So I would go over to her house and it was kind of like hilarious now I think back on it. But I'd go over to her house with her kids and her husband and have dinner sometimes and I'd be sitting there and they'd think I'm a friend from mum's work, except I look exactly like mum.
Yeah, wow. So, and no one put the like two together.
They didn't say,
but how young were they when you?
I mean, I guess they were about 13 and 15.
And they all know now.
They do know now, yes.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
I know.
Yeah, that's huge. Yeah. And I just wanted to go back when you mentioned about when you went to FACTS and there was a social worker involved to help you find your birth parents or natural birth parents or whatever the terminology is. Yeah. You mentioned like having, you know, receiving no counselling at the time and when there probably should have been some definite things, fundamentals in place, like tips, sharing of experiences, what to expect, you know, expectation versus reality, all that kind of stuff. Do you want to give some tips? Because I know we were chatting about this before, that maybe social workers consider when they're speaking to an adopted person and they're starting their search. What sort of, based on your experience, what do you think should have happened instead of just giving you that A3 folder and it says, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think the reality is that most reunited or reunions don't play out particularly well or aren't maintained for the very long term. And, you know, I think that is the reality of the situation. I feel like, you know, I was unrealistically excited of meeting her. I think I was looking for some kind of escape from my reality at the time. a friend of mine a couple of days ago said to me when I was talking to her about doing this, and she said, because I met her just before I met this friend, just before I met my birth mum. She said she was going to solve all your problems, Joe. And I said, really? Is that how you perceived it? I said, I guess I was like that. You know, I guess, yeah, I just, you know, I it was just a way of finding something. But definitely I should have been given counselling. I mean, I was 19 years old. And there was the pressure of my adoptive mum not wanting me to proceed with it. So it wasn't like I could come home and sort of have a debrief, or it wasn't like anyone was happy for me that I was finding this part of myself, which, you know, I want to be really clear, all adoptees deserve to know their ancestry, their origins, who they are, who they come from. You know, even if those people don't want to be in reunion or whatever, it's my view that all adoptees have the right to know as much as possible. So, yeah, definitely counselling. And I really feel that I should have been sort of counselled to be cautiously optimistic about it. You know, it probably wouldn't have stopped me, but I probably should have had counselling with my adoptive mum and dad, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing is that perhaps it wasn't understood like it is now, but, you know, the trauma that the birth mother goes through and the trauma that the baby goes through means that the reunion process is almost always destined to fail, you know, so...
Yeah, it's definitely going to be rocky. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what I didn't know with my experience as well. Like, I mean, you kind of just go in expecting them to love you or to, I don't know, it's like, and you forget that they actually chose not to look after you in the first. You kind of dismiss that because you're so ready to search and meet them again that you think somehow it's going to change.
You definitely expect a connection of some kind.
Yeah.
And I didn't have that.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. Yeah. I mean, I had it to a degree with my adoptive mum, but yeah, the attachment wasn't really there. I mean, I have a good relationship with my adoptive mum, you know, I do, but it doesn't take away from the impact of being relinquished at birth, for sure.
So you had met you've met your birth mum, you had been going over to dinners with the family and but then you had a really difficult time, the second part of your story, which is this part, which is, yeah, quite devastating.
Yeah. So after knowing my birth mum for almost, you know, 20 years it was, I mean, we didn't have a close relationship because I was living in Sydney, she was living in country South Australia eventually. But, yeah, after almost 20 years of knowing each other, and we were still seeing each other maybe once or twice a year if we could, we became estranged. And that was sort of very quickly after she had visited me and my family in Sydney for a long weekend. And, yeah, that just sort of was the trigger for an incredibly difficult time for me. You know, it was so painful on so many levels, and part of it was because my kids were used as the reason for her pulling out of the relationship. And I won't go into the specifics of that, but it just, you know, it was just like a kick in the guts, basically. And I just feel like I had a broken heart for like a year. And I really, you know, I struggled with suicidal thoughts. You know, my mental health was just, had just taken a beating, I guess, you know. And I just felt that like no one in my inner circle could acknowledge or understand what I was going through, you know. I just sort of, it was a bit like, oh, not, you know, Joe's adopted story again, you know, or, you know, sometimes I'd wake up crying in the morning and my husband would say, Jo, what's wrong? What's wrong? You know? And I'd say, oh, you know, I just, you know, I'd relate it back to this whole end of the relationship. And he just couldn't understand. But of course, they can't, no one can understand it. It's a very specific thing. And a lot of it, a lot of the emotions and the feelings are sort of connect back beyond conscious memory. So it's sort of cellular. And yeah, I mean, they talk about secondary rejection. I don't think that terminology is really used anymore because it's so negative and, you know, think that you are a person who's experienced secondary rejection in your life is kind of shit. But I mean, I do sort of now feel, as I guess with the benefit of maturity, that it's less about the personalities and the people involved during that whole time, and it's much more about the act of relinquishing a child or being forced in a way to relinquish a child, and the dynamics around adoption and the inherent loss of identity that is the real problem. And, you know, I really have a very strong feeling that adoption agencies, state governments, whoever, who forcibly took babies away from their mothers immediately after birth should be held accountable, because they should be held accountable, or there should now be some kind of redress scheme. I know there was one slated for Victoria in the last couple of years. I don't know if that has come to fruition, but I mean, they operated adoption agencies with a definite clean break policy, which was that it was better for the mother to never have contact or see the child that they've just given birth to. And I mean, as babies, we're born helpless, as are all mammals, you know, and we have an innate expectation for immediate contact and to be nurtured. And, you know, there was the Harvard Center on the Developing Child did a big research study in 2012, I think, and, you know, they have this theory that the first 9 months outside of the uterus has been called, like, it, you know, they call it external gestation, and it's such an incredibly important time. And for the adopted child, that is utterly broken, you know. So it's a big deal. It's a big deal.
Yeah.
When it's you living it.
That's right. Yeah. That's exactly right. And like you said, it is on that cellular level, and it's, you can't explain it to people who don't have it. Yeah, so much happens in the first 9 months of life, and in our first 9 months, it's just, the attachment is just there. You're trying to attach or not attach. It's like just completely broken.
Yeah, I've got a photo that I found when I was packing up my mum's house when she went into a nursing home, my adoptive mum, and it's a photo of me sitting in a baby bassinet, and there's my adoptive family on one side of the bassinet, and there's me looking away like I'm looking for someone else. And I mean, who knows? Maybe that's a convenient. It just struck me when I looked at it, I was like, okay.
It's a powerful photo there.
It is for me.
That type of me.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. And I guess because of your complexion, I assume that your adoptive parents don't have the same sort of complexion.
Well, my adoptive dad actually sort of had more olive skinned, thank goodness, really, for my mum. I'm sure she was happy about that. She actually used to always say, oh, no, she looks.
She gets it from the father.
She looks like her dad.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, like my, she, it's just like a funny story that just has always stayed with me. She used to, you know, have a shop, and I'd work there sometimes with her, and, you know, customers would come in, a lady came in and you know, my mum would always say, oh, this is my daughter. You know, this is my daughter, Joanne. And I'd like, oh, hi, you know, and then this lady was, oh, she doesn't look anything like you, you know, or something. And, you know, mum would say, oh, she's like, you know, it's like, she's like her dad, or she looks just like her dad, or, you know.
And that's like the insensitive nature of just people in the public eye when they just say random things, which really just sort of shoots you right in the heart. It did for me anyway.
Absolutely. I remember as a kid wishing that I had been adopted from overseas so that it was obvious, so that it was completely, you know, unequivocal that I was adopted. I always wished I was Korean or something. So that was just like there wasn't any pretense, you know. Mm. It was always pretending. It was, you know, our friend Gabor Mate says being adopted is expecting the child to act normally in an abnormal situation. It's so true.
No, it was a video. I might share it later. I don't have the words on how to explain, but basically it was just saying that a lot of the information and memory and, you know, of course, nutrients and blood and all that sort of thing, but trauma, and if the mother is pregnant and has decided during gestation that she's going to give her child up for adoption, relinquish her child, that information, that message gets sent to the baby via the umbilical cord. Well, and just, yeah.
They have the sense that you're unwanted.
Yeah. So even, you know, right back then.
In utero, like, yeah.
Yeah, in utero,
You know, I think from what I've read, you're developing in utero, your brain development, you're either developing a fragile framework or a sturdy framework. And when the mother is under stress and there's high cortisol levels and all that sort of stuff, then, you know, your framework for the platform for you to proceed on with life is fragile. So, you know, the way that you have relationships, the way that you communicate, the way everything is impacted because of that time as well.
Yeah, so then it brings me to my next question about how being adopted has, and your experiences that you've gone through, has affected your relationship. So, you know, you mentioned before, like, with your husband, but what about, like, your kids, close friends, and even yourself?
Yeah, I have an exaggerated sense of rejection for sure. And that has played out a lot with my husband over the years. I mean, we've been married for more than 20 years now. And then, of course, there's the whole thing about intergenerational trauma, which I have seen played out in my kids. That story I was telling you about being dropped off to camp as a young kid, both my children had massive separation anxiety from me. And certainly that could have been me projecting onto them, but, you know, it was also them. And I've seen the ripple effect through the generations. I have with them. Yeah.
And you're mentioning about, like, hypervigilant.
Yeah.
Hypervigilant kind of.
I think a lot of adoptive people are hypervigilant. So that for me has played out with how I've parented my kids. I mean, I've always had this sense of, like, without being melodramatic, dread, or that, you know, there's danger around the corner. And obviously that is not functional parenting at all.
Well, I guess what constitutes normal, you know, that may be a normal reaction to, you know, you just don't know, but at what point does it become hypervigilant?
It definitely has escalates. Been over it, at some times hypervigilant, where I've just had this, like, fear, this just impending fear of, in relation to my kids and their activities and actions and stuff, and unfounded, I guess, fear. You know, obviously everyone has concerns and stuff, but yeah, it definitely has led to some. I am hypervigilant with them, and I have to sort of try and be objective.
Yep.
You know.
And when you are like that, do you have a gauge point? So, you know, you might check in with your husband and work out, you know, or check in with the kids even, or maybe their reaction is like, Mom, like, we're fine. I've got this, I'm fine. Like,
I think they're both my saving grace, because, you know, they are both very strong minded individuals, thank goodness.
Yeah.
So, you know, they don't let me get away with too much bullshit.
Well, if they've got, like, the, so if they've got the hypervigilance passed down, then they've also got high achievement.
Exactly.
Yeah,
yes.
So we've got to count in the good stuff that we can bring, not just the
negative.
There
you go. There are some positives out of it as well. Yeah, that's so funny, the high achievement thing. Like, they all pay me out, like, what course are you going to do next, Mum? You know, like, are you going to try and do medicine at uni? When are you going to enroll and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah.
So, yes, I have done a few different courses and had a couple of different
lots
life
of
paths.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Yeah, no, I can relate to that as well. So, you know, you've mentioned you've had lots of different types of careers. You're very hypervigilant, high achiever. You know, you must have lots of different projects at the same, you know, lots of different ideas on how to achieve and, you know, aspire to be a better version of you and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And probably more so wanting that than maybe a non-adopted person. So it's kind of goes into a bit of overdrive sometimes.
Yes.
But you and I both met on a yoga retreat and, you know, you were mentioning over the phone how yoga has just helped you so much with that. So I just wanted to talk in maybe with you in more detail about how yoga has helped you being, I guess, more connected to yourself and, I guess, to try and combat those things that we adopted people face.
Yes. I think the first thing to say about yoga is that it saved my life when I was going through that very difficult period when I first became estranged from my birth mother. And then I would say, fast forward to now, when I practice yoga, it brings me relief for sure. It feels like coming home and I feel more whole, no question. You know, Patanjali's Yoga Sutra 1.2, I think it is, is yoga's chitta vritti nirodha, yoga's chitti vritti nirodha, which is essentially about yoga softening the fluctuations of the mind, and we keep practicing until the river runs clear. You know, it's about the stilling of the mind until it rests in tranquility, and so that you experience life as it is in reality. And you know, becoming a yoga teacher has been part of my journey. It's been fantastic to have found that. So it makes me emotional because I think that is the best thing that adoption has led me to. And, you know, it takes me inward. And, you know, I listened to your interview with Lane Beachley and she said something that really resonated with me, which was, I've written it down because I wanted to get it, I wanted to quote her correctly. She said that we can't keep looking outside ourselves to seek validation and self-worth. We have to draw on our inner resolve. You know, we can't keep waiting for people to tell us we're a good girl or you're doing a good job or how pretty you are or that they're proud of you, because the next person won't think that. I mean, you know, it's not. So I guess yoga takes me inward to that inner part of me, like I suppose what the ocean does for Lane.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's, I guess, that was so well said. You know, I feel that yoga has done that for me also.
Do you?
Absolutely, yeah. And it's, yeah, it has given so much to me. Yeah, it's filled me up from the inside in a way that I've never experienced before.
I would agree with that statement too.
Yeah.
I feel the same way.
And it is a combination of, you know, the practice itself, the physical practice and the challenges that arise in your mind as you're practicing those challenging poses. But it has so much to offer. It has like the eight arms of, you know, the reading, you know, yoga sutras, connecting with like-minded people, trying to do things with purpose. That's why I really liked Duncan Peake's retreat, because it wasn't just about learning about the individual poses and breaking them down from that physical level and all of the muscles and origins and insertions and all like that. That was all there, but at nighttime when he was talking about the philosophy and the the four life stages. Yeah, it makes life more meaningful. It makes more sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it does, you allow yourself to drop into this side of yourself, which is so much more rewarding. And I think this day and age, it's really important to remember, you know, like it's so easy to get swept up in that external validation sort of pathway because yes. I don't necessarily want to tell myself, oh, I'm enough, I'm good enough, I'm great, and because I don't know if I truly believe that.
I don't know if I do either.
Yeah.
it's a journey to get there.
Yeah, it's a self-worth thing of like, do I, yeah, and it's a daily practice, it's a daily battle. But yeah, I'm along the same lines as you. I think I'm so grateful that yoga found me and I found yoga and I've wanted to explore the whole yoga pathway, not just going to the gym and doing a yoga class. It sort of became a lot more than that. And it almost like, was it like, it keeps you buoyant.
Yes, it definitely does. Yeah. It does keep you buoyant. I mean, yes, the whole yoga philosophy is a ginormous ocean, universe of information and learning. And so it's wonderful, really.
Yeah, it works. And just, you know, everyone, not everyone finds, you know, it's someone has a different thing for them. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, you can definitely see it in Lane. You can definitely see the way that she loves the water and the ocean, and she's found her kind of like dharma, or she's found her pure joy, her pure bliss.
Yeah.
What is it, samadhi?
Samadhi, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. You know, if we didn't have yoga, in my mind I'm like, what would I – I'd be lost. I'd really be struggling, I think.
Yes. It is a very, for me, fulfilling practice.
I just wanted to ask like a final, because I'm pretty sure the other questions we've kind of, do you think we've kind of?
Yeah, I think sort of about my adoptive family. I guess I just wanted to say that, you know, if any of my adoptive cousins listen to this, I have good relationships with them, but I know for sure they would be shocked at what I've been saying. They would have no idea, even though I grew up with them from being a baby, they would have had no idea that I felt and feel this way about my experience of being an adopted person and how that felt growing up. You know, adoption has always been sold in as the, you know, the adoptee being so lucky and, wow, you really won the jackpot with your mum and dad and the gift of adoption and all that. But, you know, I am speaking my truth. And, I mean, in adoption, we should not be talking about what the adults want or need or feel, but about the emotional experience of the infant. And that's one of abandonment. There's no two ways around it.
And what do you think their reaction is going to be? Do you think they're going to have a, oh, wow, I didn't know that about you, and, oh, my gosh, like, do you think they'd have this kind of profound realization that it's more than just, you know, being grateful and you've been brought up in a lovely home and went to a private school and you've had so much given to you, you know, what have you got to complain about? Do you think that they're going to have a positive reaction if they were listening to this?
A couple, one or two might. One or two would have the other alternative reaction, I'm sure, that, you know, God, what have you got to complain about? But there's, you know, as I said, that's how adoption's been positioned over the years, certainly back then. And the forced removal, relinquishment at birth.
Yeah.
It creates lifelong trauma.
Yeah. And just to add to here that, like, they put a pillow over your mum, like, I mean, it just doesn't, like, when you hear about that now, you just think that's
torture.
Absolutely.
I mean, it must have been torture at the time.
Because we've had kids, and like, to even, you'd go completely apeshit. You would go absolutely ballistic.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that clean break policy. And I was completely obsessive when I had my first child, that he was, like, immediately put on me, like, put him on me straight away, put him on me, and I wouldn't let him go.
Yeah, I can see why.
Yeah.
So tell me about next steps for you in regards to getting your integrated birth certificate.
Yeah, well, I've applied for it from the South Australian government. I'm sending all the paperwork, so I'm just waiting now to hear back from them. And, you know, it's a small but important step for me because it's another part of my truth.
Yeah.
It's my identity before I was adopted, and it's very, very important to me. So I'm just waiting to see what happens. But I do think more broadly that, you know, there should be a redress scheme for adopted people like me and potentially the birth mothers that were impacted as well. Because it has created lifelong trauma for a whole population of people.
In addition to this interview, there were about 150,000 adoptions in Australia from the 1950s to the early 1980s, when unmarried women were routinely shamed and coerced into surrendering their babies. 10 years on from the historic apology made by then Prime Minister Julia Gillard to those affected by the forced adoptions era, survivors like Jo are still pushing for support. Little has been done to help us overcome the significant challenges we face. In addition to redress schemes, she also believes there should be appropriate memorials in locations where forced adoptions occurred to commemorate and acknowledge the injustices. No good will come of sweeping this under the carpet, she says. Thank you for listening. Join us next time on My Unknown Truth.